Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode of A Taste of the Past is brought to you by the University of California Press, publishers of The Georgian Feast, The Vibrant Culture and Savory Food of the Republic of Georgia, by Dara Goldstein.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this journey through culinary history. And recently, I had the pleasure and the good fortune to make another trip to Rome, which I try to do as regularly as possible. Doesn't always work out. And on that trip, I had the pleasure of meeting up with Karima Moyer Nocchi. And she took me and suggested we visit this exhibit, took me to this marvelous exhibit at the Biblioteca Casatanese. Casatanense, right. An 18th century library, which was gorgeous. And just as gorgeous as a library is, the exhibit was on scents and flavors, odors and flavors. How would you translate that, Karima?
Aromi and sapori.
Yes. It's scents and flavors.
Right.
And it was a wonderful, I would say, we're talking the Renaissance writers and their cookbooks early, and these were some of the original copies, and it was a fabulous exhibit. Mm. And I thank you so much for suggesting that and meeting me there and doing that. And actually, Karima is talking about books, an author in her own right, and has written a couple of books. Karima was born in the United States and immigrated to Italy in 1990. She is a lecturer at the University of Siena in the Modern Languages Department and teaches food studies at the University of Rome Tor Vergata. Her first book, Chewing the Fat, An Oral History of Italian Foodways from Fascism to Dolce Vita, came out in 2015, and it received critical acclaim. It's the food we know about Italy, as we were talking earlier, the cucina povera. She currently resides in Umbria and is here in New York on a bit of a lecture tour, not just New York, here in other places, a little lecture tour about
New Haven and Boston.
In New Haven at Yale to do some lecturing on a new project and a new book that is soon to come out called The Eternal Table, A Cultural History of Food in Rome, an epic culinary history spanning from the pre-Romans to present day. It'll be published in January of 2019?
Actually, it's coming out in March.
Okay.
Right.
So look for that by Roman and Littlefield, and that'll be wonderful. It's part of the Big City Biography Series edited by Ken Albala. We've had a couple of those books on. And something that Ken writes about the series that you have written this book for is that food helps define the cultural identity of cities in much the same way as the distinctive architecture and famous personalities. And that could not be truer than the food of Rome and the city of Rome, that there's so much to identify Roman culture. Food is one element of it, but food is such a huge element of it. Mm-hmm. And this book that you write, Karima, The Eternal Table, it's a history of the food, the gastronomy, and cuisine of Rome. You say that it is a cultural history. It's the food culture as much as it is actually the actual food. And you write about the role that food played in the development of the city and how it led to the individuation of gastronomy with a uniquely Roman stamp, which once again harkens back to what Ken had said, that food is an identifier of a city. And you start, however, with the pre-Roman era. Why did you feel it was so necessary to go back so far to tell the story of the food of Rome?
Well, I go back actually to the geological history. And granted that geomorphology is not one of today's sexy buzzwords, but a broad spectrum examination of a culinary history of a single limited location should begin by addressing what the available resources were. So, and how these first inhabitants, in this case, the Latins coming down from the Po Valley into this area, what they were going to encounter, and how that meshed with their already developed culture, because they came with a culture, and how that was going to mix with the natural resources and influence then the culinary trajectory. So in the area called Latium Vetus, which is Old Lazio, it was particularly interesting because there were a number of features that are called marginal landscapes. And the marginal landscapes would be swamps, volcanic activity, impassable forest areas, a fire-prone scrubland, clay-like soil and wispy topsoil. These are the things that these first inhabitants were going to use as the building blocks for Rome. And they use these marginal landscapes, and so it puts us in a position of thinking about human ingenuity versus environmental determinism. And so just thinking about those things in particular and using some examples, at the base of the swamplands, you had salt, which was so important to the development of Rome. The volcanic soil was good for growing grapes. The scrubland was full of aromatic herbs, and the abundance of clay would then provide the materials for making the amphorae.
That's right. And that's so much of what we know about their past is finding these shards and these these old vessels.
Monte Testaccio.
In Testaccio region, right. And even the residues found within that tell us what might have been carried in these, aside from oil and wine.
Right. Yes.
Garum, wonderful things. Yeah, right. The book is structured in such a way, it's not what I expected to be this, you said pre-Roman to, to the present day, more
Yikes.
Or less.
Right.
I said, well, how many volumes is this going to be? How huge a book is this going to be? Mm-hmm. It's really not that big. And I must say, I was surprised by the fact that it is so readable. It's like I don't want to say a popular history, a popular history book, but it is a cultural treatise of the food and the time, condensed in such a way that you don't have to go, year by year all along, and
right.
and you give the grouping in the periods. But how did you structure it to cover such a vast amount of time?
Yes, indeed, covering 2,500 years of a culinary history, but an exceptionally multifaceted place like Rome. So it's not just the amount of time. And that's no small task. And it needed to be addressed both vertically and horizontally, materially and conceptually. So I begin with having a diachronic approach in the first two chapters. They're set out chronologically, beginning again with the geomorphology and then moving through the first chapter to the founding of Rome so that base is done. Moving in, then continuing in a chronological way into the next chapter with the era of kings, the republic, and the all-important Roman Empire. The rise and fall of Roman Empire, and then the rise of Christianity.
So we're talking like 500 BC to 500 CE.
Right, right. So that's covered in the first two chapters. So all of this, of course, is seen through the lens of food, which, as Andrew McGowan very well succinctly stated, history seems to have been written through the ages as if no one ever ate. The other chapters then move on in a topical way, covering the kinds of things one would expect, the culinary literature, markets, and so on. And those move, however, concentrically. That is, that they go back to ancient Rome and then move on through time, each one focusing on the areas of time according to that topic. So in the end, what you have at the end of the five chapters of topical chapters that move concentrically, that refer to one another in a dialogical sort of way, and they become cross-referential as a whole. Hmm. And that way, the an entire picture can be presented of such a long period of time.
Yeah. I mean, and even though at times there are vast differences of those periods, there is something, there is that thread that kind of, you know, holds it all together. Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Well, what, when you say a cultural history of food, what precisely do you mean by the cultural history?
Well, I'm looking at this as a single volume, longitudinal kind of examination. Now, these topics have been dealt with in various ways, in various formats as well. For example, the incredible body of literature that's been done on ancient Rome, lots of articles, lots of tomes, and moving on also to food apps even that give you a little bit of culture and but a single volume that allows that to be traced is what I meant by, I take the term cultural history with it very broadly. So I mean to examine history from a multidisciplinary, multifaceted mode of inquiry, to bring together social sciences, the usual kinds of things with food, culture and food, sociology, anthropology, and in this case, very important theology, also philosophy, the political sciences, as well as economic factors, the history of labor, botany, archaeology, a wide range then of literary genres, with primary source literary genres, as they regard gastronomy and enology. In order to trace not only what I'm trying to trace here is the meaning of food and not to create a grocery list of who was influencing the food and not only the native population, but whoever had a vested interest in it.
Right. Well, in doing research, anyone who's done any reading or research in the ancients and in the food world and food history, you know that they don't just give you, as you just said, you know, a grocery list. They just don't spew out a recipe and say, this is what we had for dinner. It's right. All couched within health and science, and
right.
And there's always an intro about how it should be, how one should eat it, where one should eat it, when one should eat it. So it really is understandable that this is how you would approach it. And I keep thinking of volumes of Pliny, the elder, which you were talking about,
right,
you know,
right.
The botany and everything else. I mean, this is, all of these are brought into it. And then a lot of fact and fiction, and how do you, you know, it's tough to separate because we know that so many of the writings are also a little bit of a work of fiction, like the satires, but of course they're based on what they knew. So where do you go for, you know, for the definitive information?
I don't know that definitive information is necessarily my aim as much as allowing for a fair mix. So when you go back to with the literature and you go back to the inception of Latium Vetus and the the great agricultural treatises. So the things about running an estate, and that has a mix as well about how to venerate the gods and ritual foods. But then you can move on as well to Galen and a medical treatise, which he gives us a rare glimpse about what poor people were eating. Which you're not going to get
rare
so much, right?
Yeah,
that's very rare,
right?
And also his take on the sociology of food, what you should eat, how you should eat it, as you had said. Then the highlight, of course, of the Roman era, the ancient Roman era, is Apicius. And there wouldn't be another recipe compilation for another 1,000 years. So at which point we get into sort of this era, the tri-era of Maestro Martino, who comes out in 1465 with his Art of Cooking. Then his book is importantly picked up by Platina, who elaborates the text in Latin. And in doing so, he elevates the culinary arts to the humanities. It becomes a work of the salon, if you will, a coffee table book, to be read by learned men, hopefully learned women, but doubtful. And then 100 years later, you get the jewel, perhaps, of Roman cookery, which is Bartolomeo Scarpi's opera.
And we were so fortunate to be able to see
one
of the original copies.
It was a chilling moment for me.
Yeah. Well, backing up a little bit, you had talked about some of the foundational culinary values of the ancient Romans and how that's carried through to today. Is there one thing in particular that you would say, or a couple things, if you want? There were times they had to really learn how to feed the people in the urban areas. I mean, people outside of the urban areas knew they could forage and they could grow. Was this a call to farming, or was it?
Oh, there was a definite call to farming, and it's something that's repeated because the stalwart farmer figure is the main value of the ancient Romans. So there's this Hollywood image of the Roman who is feasting until he is full to bursting, and then voids the contents of his stomach to recommence gorging again. We've become not only familiar with this idea, but really just enamored of it to the point that we don't want to acknowledge maybe that parsimony was very important to the Romans. And then as Rome expanded and new foods started coming in, luxury items started coming in, what you have then is a backlash against novelty because it was too much too fast. And so you have the writings of Cato and the natural historian Pliny the Elder, who sees these foreign foods as things that corrupt tradition. They weaken the collective identity, and it's an identity that's based on the civilization, what they thought of the civilization of the appetite, so very much against hunting and all towards husbandry and how one was supposed to eat. And this is a kind of universal fear that you can see in any sort of fundamentalism. And you've often said on your show, What's old is new, and it works the other way as well, that novelties, once they've been rejected, we can take, for example, fish, which is so much associated with the Mediterranean diet, but Pliny railed against fish as not being proper Roman food.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, as time goes on, these novelties and things that people are against get absorbed into the culinary grammar, and then they in their own time, morph into traditions and take on the aura of timelessness themselves. And it's a pattern that gets repeated throughout Roman history, because meaning and identity are not immutable.
Right.
They're in a constant state of evolution.
Right. In fact, common thread, you say, throughout this book is mobility as a defining characteristic of Rome itself.
Right.
And how do you, so this
And you can't
mobility.
Have mobility without without change, without mutability. Right,
right. Right. Mm. Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned fish, because they, the early Romans, the pre-Romans, if you will, they didn't go to the sea mm-hmm. for sustenance. They did not eat from the sea as much. I mean, that came much later in terms of their
much later
hunger
right,
for
right,
it.
Right,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. We move on. I mean, well, we move on to the we move on quite a ways when you go forward, and you have to read the book to find out all the periods. But you know, we've got to bring ourselves to something that we can identify with. Sure, we read about all these grand. You think of Roman food, and you think of these humongous banquets, as you mentioned before, mm-hmm. gorging themselves, and slaves, you know, slicing things and feeding it to them. But then we move on to, austerity times. But we're going to talk about that when we come back after a short break. So stay tuned.
This episode of A Taste of the Past is brought to you by the University of California Press, publishers of The Georgian Feast, The Vibrant Culture and Savory Food of the Republic of Georgia by Dara Goldstein. According to Georgian legend, God took a supper break while creating the world. He became so involved with his meal that he inadvertently tripped over the high peaks of the Caucasus, spilling his food onto the land below. The land blessed by heaven's table scraps became Georgia. Winner of the International Association of Culinary Professionals Julia Child Award for Cookbook of the Year, the first edition of the Georgian Feast introduced a generation of cooks to the rich and robust cuisine and culture of Georgia. These classic recipes, ranging from savory Hachapuri cheese bread to traditional appetizers and cakes, are guaranteed to excite new generations of home cooks for years to come. Recently revised and expanded, this new 25th anniversary edition features new photography, recipes, and an essay from celebrated wine writer Alice Firing. Pick up The Georgian Feast by Dara Goldstein, available now wherever books are sold.
Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Karima Moyer Noki, and she has she's a historian and a professor of languages, and she has a new book coming out in a couple of months called The Eternal Table, and it is all about the food of Rome, a cultural history of the food of Rome. And Karima, the ancient Romans are of great interest to so many people, and that you really need time to just pore over and read and kind of immerse yourself in that feeling of yesteryear. But something we can really identify with is more when we get into the period that actually has more carryover into today's time, and that would be Cucina Romanesca. Talk a little bit about that.
In the chapter on the Cucina Romanesca is the one that I don't start back with ancient Rome. I begin with Martin V and his movement into the return of the papacy to Rome. And with him, he had his cook who was responsible for all of the non-papal sort of dinners. So, and in this cookbook, he's created this cookbook which is preparing him for people who are going to be coming into Rome to the Santa Sede from all walks of life. And so it's very interesting to see the sorts of foods that he believes are, because after every recipe, there's a listing of who this food would be appropriate for. Hmm. And so it's such an interesting sociological study. But the Cucina Romanesca, then, you have this juxtaposition in time of the Cucina Cardinalizia, which is that for the high clergy, and the Cucina Popolare. I reserve a Cucina Povera for a different sort of discourse of people who are not necessarily, who are getting maybe a substandard kind of nutritional mm-hmm. Profile. but the cucina popolare is what the populace, people who were eating, could afford to eat and what they were, and how those two sort of come together over time and the way that comes together. You have what I call the triple matrix of the Romanesca, which is the Roman Jewish food, and then the food of the Quinto Quarto, the Testaccio, the urban areas, and also the food that originated sort of outside of the urban framework of Rome. So you can say sort of into the countryside. And within that, we get into the very interesting topic of the carbonara, pasta alla carbonara, which could not have been ignored given its the fascinating, uniquely fascinating sociological study that it's become.
It's interesting. I just recently ran a show during the same visit to Rome, and I spoke with a good friend, Katie Parlow, who's been on the show very much, and I questioned her on why all of a sudden are we seeing this, and this is old food. Why are we suddenly seeing these dishes brought back to popularity? And especially since you mentioned early on there, the food in the cultural treatment of food history, it's political, it's religious. I mean, you can't separate the mm-hmm. sociology, you know, the religion and politics from what people have available to them to eat. So this is interesting because carbonara sort of is the poster child for that food. Yeah.
And the first time that it's mentioned, it's not, and I'm getting my, I know that this is a very sensitive point for a lot of people. So my source for this is Alberto Capatti, a culinary scholar, who says that the first time carbonara is written as a term and means that food is in 1954. Even though we this is again something that we've taken on and we want to believe that it started out somehow with the Romans, and its origins are various in their history. They're many and various, and incidentally, as are the ingredients, many and various, the preparation methods as well. But I don't think there's any other Italian food right now that so incites the fury of the authenticity police than this dish.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me because it's also sort of a, as far as the collection of ingredients goes, it's kind of a no-brainer that it was going to happen. And yet we want to believe that, for some reason, that it has a specific origin, it has specific ingredients. Because of the international vehemence around it, I do an extended examination of it, highlighting then using it as a vehicle to highlight issues of authenticity and to open a dialogue about the flexibility of what culinary grammar is regarding a certain location. Once something gets dubbed traditional, it just becomes a hot item in that sort of way. If I could give an example of the ways that carbonara, just the usefulness of the term, once you get outside of the Stazione Termini in Rome, there's a strip of Muslim proprietors who have fast food stands. And each one of the foods that they offer are pictured on a little cartello. On a picture card. And so their carbonara, because of their dietary laws, is called carbonara chicken and cream. But they've got the little bits of red pepper on top so that it looks the right way. Now, when you're talking about culinary appropriation, can we keep calling that carbonara when so many people get incensed if you even think about adding butter or cream? And then taking that a step further, the vegans have have a vegan carbonara sauce that comes in a jar, and you've taken out the eggs, the cheese, and the guanciale.
What do you have left?
At that point, what is it that's carbonara right. about that? And so that's also, it speaks about the power of the name of this dish.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It does. I mean, people go and make that pilgrimage to Rome in search of the perfect carbonara.
Right, right, right. As people once did with pizza.
Yeah,
Which created the pizza effect then. Yeah.
Right. You know, we kind of didn't glossed over a period. Well, we glossed over a lot of periods. But as I say, buy the book when it comes out and read it. But to the fact about a recipe and something being traditional and that awful word, authentic. We don't like
right.
that, right? Classic, okay. There was a cookbook author who really, codified so many of the recipes that people identify with as Roman cooking, and that's Ada Boni, mm-hmm. one of many. She did not have a recipe for carbonara in her book, did she?
No, she didn't have a recipe.
No, I have the her famous book is the Talisman di Felicità, and there are some horrible, almost like bastardized editions in English.
I didn't know that particular one had been translated mm-hmm. into English. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
it's a very much abridged version.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yes.
And so it's not. But anyway, she doesn't,
the Talisman of Happiness,
yeah.
then. Right,
yeah.
right, okay. And she also has, in her book, the Cucina Romana, because Talisman of Happiness came out in 1926.
And then, after
fascism, if you think about that, it started in 1922. In 1929... And this sets up also an interesting vision of that sort of pull towards and against these forces of custom and tradition and authenticity, because she already in 1929 wrote this book called The Cucina Romana about popular Roman food, of which she was not of that class because she was upper middle class, but it was still very much in her heart. You can tell by the way that she writes this book.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't include the carbonara.
No. Well, and as you say, really the first written recipe was 1954.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
And she... So in that particular book, though, you can see her... loving this sort of traditional thing, and yet in Talisman of Happiness, which was she was a fascist proponent, and moving towards the future, so that pull, that contrast between those two things is very much a part of Italian food today and Roman food as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because her. The other recipes, you know, hold true. Whereas somebody like you and I had been speaking a couple of weeks ago about Luigi Carnacina.
Right.
His recipes were really the Alta Cucina, the French adaptations
right.
of recipes in with Italian ingredients.
Okay, and so in his cookbook, which is called Roma in Cucina,
mm-hmm.
In 1962 then, so this is when the Dolce Vita has already taken off, the economic miracle has already taken off. His carbonara, and he is a chef, he's Roman, he's writing a book about Roman food, has both butter and cream in it.
Yep.
The
some onions for good measure.
There's hair-raising ingredients, yes.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because everyone gets to write their own adaptation. You see that in cookbooks today, even,
yes.
you know, the
but
recipes.
But not the carbonara.
Yep,
right,
but
yeah.
No, do not mess with the carbonara. And speaking of the, you know, carbonara being, you know, people go in search of the Holy Grail, if you will, the
exactly.
you know, the carbonara. There's this whole thing about eating out in Rome, mm-hmm. and it has a long and varied history as well. So, what is your take on that? And you talk about that in the book. You treat that.
Yeah. Yes, it's a problem for chefs today, who these terms like traditional, authentic, genuine, even regional, are really weighty, and they set up expectations and for paying customers, because most of the it can't be denied that that's a motivating force. Most of the customers, one can say very clearly about Rome, are coming in for that Holy Grail. So what kind of room does that leave? They're shopping for that supposedly authentic experience. What kind of room does that leave for a chef to continue what has always been the evolution of Italian food? Because certainly when the Latins came down, they didn't bring that sort of food, and neither is it featured so much in Apicius, because as Platina even said, now Platina's writing in the 15th century, he's a humanist, and he's very much venerating, because of that, he's very much venerating the classics. But he said, we've moved past Apicius. On the modern table, we're not interested in those tastes. We're interested in other tastes. So this proclivity for the real deal leaves little room for the evolution of Roman food that has always characterized it. And chefs are trying to find this happy medium which will allow for some self-expression and yet give that reverent nod to what has come before. Because there was a period of time when those dishes really kind of faded into the background, and people were trying to move forward, Heinz Beck and all sort of other... Mm-hmm. Chefs of that genre. And it would be a shame to stifle this evolution that is going on right now. But people do want to put their personal stamp on it, as did Bartolomeo Scappi. So why is it, when is it that time stopped? And it makes these dishes turn into something, trattorie and the osteria today. Because they're so looking back into the past, it makes them into a sort of food theater or food museum, mm-hmm. rather than something that's actually a living part of the culinary evolution.
Yeah, and there is, in fact, a little museum, the Museum of Pasta, the Pasta
right,
Museum,
right.
Which makes me think that one thing that I would like to make mention of, because we didn't have an opportunity to talk about that earlier in the show, and that is, if you were to say that the cuisine is based on one thing, the Romans really did base much of their, if not cuisine, and that's a loaded word today, their sustenance on grain.
Right. This is also looking at a choice that they had made culturally, eating what's called puls, which then developed into the word pulses, even though it was referring in this particular case to a sort of ground toasted wheat that was then made into a gruel. And then pulmentarium, which are all of the things that are surrounded by that. So they made a distinction between them and the barbarians, who were milk drinking, beer guzzling, meat eating, things that the Romans in their civility did not want to, as I was saying before, the civilization of the appetite, showing a certain sort of decorum and restraint through this choice of foods that had been raised agriculturally. And this, however, was influenced by the Greeks and as well as the Etruscans, and the Romans took it on for themselves as well, as a sign of civility and how proper eating should be done.
Yeah, interesting. And then it went. I mean, from that they transformed it into bread.
And the bread, and then the logical thing that would come out of that would be later pasta. The history of pasta may have beginnings with Apicius and things that are called the patina, but purists are not willing to say that laganum was necessarily something like lasagna, and so you get
and a patina. I think more of like a thicker omelet.
right.
So. Yeah. Interesting. There's so much so much history, but but so much interesting history too. And the dole. I mean, the dole. You know, the public assistance. It was, you know, it was all grain. And then it turned to bread. Right.
It was grain, but interesting that the communion with the gods started off being through meat. That's how you commune with the gods. It was. For some of the food was distributed, and for some people, that was their opportunity to actually get some protein through animal sources. But you take that sort of source and then move it into also deified the goddess Annona, because the Roman grain supply was also deified. It was a sort of communion, but with a goddess of the state.
She was actually pictured on the coins, so she would be imprinted with her picture on the coins.
And there are a few statues. I have one of those coins, actually. and then that moves on. I'm simplifying here, and I realize that, but moves on then into the Eucharist and allows that bridge to take place between meat eating, grain consuming, and then making that bread the body of Christ. So so that meat then becomes bread.
Yeah, it's political,
and,
it's religious.
And they
it's...
and interestingly, the Christian liturgy picks up the Mediterranean triad of wine, oil, and bread. And also interesting about those three products is that they are not naturally produced. So that means that they need to be manipulated by human beings before they become those products. So bread, oil, and wine, which is part of the ideal then of the Romans.
Right. Excellent point. Excellent point. Excellent work. The book is really very interesting. And
thank you.
As I say, you cover a vast amount of time in a very readable and I would say, you know, it's brief period, brief time. It's not the daunting book that I, you know, thought, oh, and how am I ever going to get through this before I speak to you about it. It is really very readable. It's just hard to tear myself away from, too.
Oh, thank you so
good.
Much. Yes, yes.
So thank you so much for taking the time on your trip here to speak with us here on A Taste of the Past.
Thank you, Linda. It's been a pleasure.
Well, yes. And I encourage my listeners to look for your book. It comes out in March. And once again, it's called The Eternal Table. It does have a subtitle then, too. Oh, The Eternal Table, A Cultural History of Food in Rome. Wonderful topic.
Okay,
wonderful
thank you.
Talk.
Thank you
Thanks
very much.
Thanks so much. And thank you for listening to what has been another Taste of the Past. And join us again here on Heritage Radio Network every week at the same time. And anywhere you get your podcasts, you can download the podcasts from iTunes, from Spotify, here at heritageradionetwork.org. And if you're so inclined, click on that little beating heart and donate to this network. Keep our shows alive and on the air. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.